Chapter 106. Another thing. You grant that God and circumstances sinned against Poe, but you also grant that he sinned against himself, a thing which he couldn't do and didn't do. It is lively up here now. I wish you could come. Here's ever, Mark, to W.D. Howells, in New York. Stormfield, Reading, Connecticut, 3 in the morning, Apple. 17:09. Written with pencil, my pen has gone dry and the ink is out of reach. Howells, did you write me day before yesterday, or did I dream it? In my mind's eye I most vividly see your hand write on a square blue envelope in the mailpull. I have hunted the house over, but there is no such letter. Was it an illusion? I am reading Lowell's letter, and smoking. I woke an hour ago, and am reading to keep from wasting the time. On page 305, vol. 1. I have just margined a note. Young friend. I like that. You ought to see him now. It seemed startlingly strange to hear a person call you young. It was a break out of a blue sky, and knocked me groggy for a moment. Ah me, the pathos of it is, that we were young then. And he, why, so was he, but he didn't know it. He didn't even know it 9 years later, when we saw him approaching and he warned me, saying, don't say anything about age, he has just turned 50, and thinks he is old, and broods over it. Well, Clara did sing. And he wrote her a dear letter. Time to go to sleep. Yours ever, Mark. To Daniel Kiefer. No date. Daniel Kiefer-esque. Dear sir, I should be far from willing to have a political party named after me. I would not be willing to belong to a party which allowed its members to have political aspirations, or to push friends forward for political preferment. Yours very truly, S50. Clemens. The copyright extension, for which the author had been working so long, was granted by Congress in 1909, largely as the result of that afternoon in Washington, when Mark Twain had adhesived in Glee Joe Cannon's private room, and preached the gospel of copyright until the daylight faded, and the rest of the Capitol grew still. Champ Clark was the last to linger that day, and they had talked far into the dusk. Clark was powerful, and had fathered the bill. Now he wrote to know if it was satisfactory. To Champ Clark, in Washington. Stormfield, Reading, Con. June 5, 2009. Dear Champ Clark, is the new copyright law acceptable to me? Emphatically, yes. Clark, it is the only sane, and clearly defined, and just and righteous copyright law that has ever existed in the United States. Whosoever will compare it with its predecessors will have no trouble in arriving at that decision. The bill which was before the committee 2 years ago, when I was down there, was the most stupefying jumble of conflicting and apparently irreconcilable interests that was ever seen. And we all said, the case is hopeless, absolutely hopeless. Out of this chaos nothing can be built. But we were in error. Out of that chaotic mass this excellent bill has been instructed. The warring interests have been reconciled, and the result is as comely and substantial a legislative edifice as lifts its domes and towers and protective lightning rods out of the statute book, I think. When I think of that other bill, which even the deity couldn't understand, and of this one which even I can understand, I take off my hat to the man, or men who devised this one. Was it R. U. Johnson? Was it the Authors League? Was it both together? I don't know, but I take off my hat, anyway. Johnson has written a valuable article about the new law. I enclose it. At last, and for the first time in copyright history, we are ahead of England. Ahead of her in two ways. By length of time, and by fairness to all interests concerned. Does this sound like shouting? Then I must modify it. All we possessed of copyright justice before the 4th of last March we owed to England's initiative. Truly yours, S50. Clemens. Because Mark Twain amused himself with certain aspects of Christian Science, and was critical of Mrs. Eddy, there grew up a wide impression that he jeered at the theory of mental healing, when, as a matter of fact, he was one of its earliest converts, and never lost faith in its power. The letter which follows is an excellent exposition of his attitude toward the institution of Christian Science and the founder of the Church in America. To J. Willie Smith, Glasgow, Scotland. Tormfield, August 7, 1909. Dear Sir, my view of the matter has not changed. To wit, that Christian Science is valuable, that it has just the same value now that it had when Mrs. Eddy stole it from Quimmy, that its healing principle, its most valuable asset, possesses the same force now that it possessed a million years ago before Quimmy was born, that Mrs. Eddy organized that force, and is entitled to high credit for that. Then, with a splendid sagacity she hitched it to a religion, the surest of all ways, to secure friends for it, and support. In a fine and lofty way, figuratively speaking, it was a tramp stealing a ride on the Lightning Express. Ah, how did that ignorant village-born peasant woman know the human being so well? As he has no more intellect than a tadpole until it comes to business, then she is a marvel. Am I sorry I wrote the book? Most certainly not. You say you have 500 converts in Glasgow. 50 years from now, your posterity will not count them by the hundred, but by the thousand. I feel absolutely sure of this. Very truly yours, S. 50. Clemens. Clemens wrote very little for publication that year, but he enjoyed writing for his own amusement, setting down the things that boiled, or bubbled, within him. Mainly chapters on the inconsistencies of human deportment, human superstition and human creeds. The letters from the earth referred to in the following were supposed to have been written by an immortal visitant from some far realm to a friend, describing the absurdities of mankind. It is true, as he said, that they would not do for publication, though certainly the manuscript contained some of his management delicious writing. Miss Wallace, to whom the next letter is written, had known Mark Twain in Bermuda, and, after his death, published a dainty volume entitled Mark Twain in the Happy Island. Tormfield, Reading, Connecticut, November 13, 1909. Dear Betsy, I've been writing letters from the earth, and if you will come here and see us, I will what? Put the MS in your hands, with the places to skip marked? No. I won't trust you quite that far. I'll read messages to you. This book will never be published. In fact, it couldn't be, because it would be felony to soil the mails with it, for it has much holy scripture in it of the kind that can't properly be read aloud, except from the pulpit and in family worship. Pain enjoys it, but pain is going to be damned one of these days, I suppose. The autumn splendors passed you by? What a pity! I wish you had been here. It was beyond words. It was heaven and hell and sunset, and rainbows and the aurora all fused into one divine harmony, and you couldn't look at it and keep the tears back. All the Hassaning strong gorgeousnesses have gone back to heaven and hell and the pole now, but no matter, if you could look out of my bedroom window at this moment, you would choke up, and when you got your voice you would say, this is not real, this is a dream. Such a singing together, and such a whispering together, and such a snuggling together of cozy soft colors, and such kissing and caressing, and such pretty blushing when the sun breaks out and catches those dainty weeds at it. You remember that weed garden of mine? And then the far hills sleeping in a dim blue trance. Oh, hearing about it is nothing. You should be here to see it. Good. I wish I could go on the platform and read. And I could, if it could be kept out of the papers. There's a charity school of 400 young girls in Boston that I would give my ears to talk to, if I had some more. But oh, well, I can't go, and it's no use to grieve about it. This morning John went to town. Also Payne. Also the butler. Also Katie. Also the laundress. The cook and the maid, and the boy and the roustabout, and John's coachman are left just enough to make it lonesome, because they are around yet never visible. However, the Harpers are sending Lee up to play billiards. Therefore I shall survive. Affectionately, S50. Clemens. Early in June that year, Clemens had developed unmistakable symptoms of heart trouble of a very serious nature. It was angina pectoris, and while to all appearances he was as well as ever and usually felt so, he was periodically visited by severe attacks of acute wrist pains which, as the months passed, increased in frequency and severity. He was alarmed and distressed not on his own account, but because of his daughter John, a handsome girl, who had long been subject to epileptic seizures. In case of his death he feared that John would be without permanent anchorage, his other daughter, Clara, following her marriage to Osip Gabrilowicz in October having taken up residence abroad. This anxiety was soon ended. On the morning of December 24th, Jean Clemens was found dead in her apartment. She was not drowned in her bath, as was reported, but died from heart exhaustion, the result of her malady and the shock of cold water. Questionable diagnosis. D. W. The blow to her father was terrible, but heavy as it was, one may perhaps understand that her passing in that swift, painless way must have afforded him a measure of relief. To Mrs. Gabrilowicz, in Europe. Reading, Con. Comma December 29, 09. Oh, Clara, Clara dear, I am so glad she is out of it and safe, safe. I am not melancholy. I shall never be melancholy again, I think. You see, I was in such distress when I came to realize that you were gone far away and no one stood between her and danger but me and I could die at any moment. And then, oh then, what would become of her? For she was willful, you know, and would not have been governable. You can't imagine what a darling she was, that last 2 or 3 days, and how fine, and good, and sweet, and noble and joyful, thank heaven, and how intellectually brilliant. I had never been acquainted with John before. I recognized that. But I mustn't try to write about her, I can't. I have already poured my heart out with the pen, recording that last day or two. I will send you that and you must let no one but Osip read it. Goodbye. I love you so. And Osip. Father. The writing mentioned in the last paragraph was his article The Death of John, apostrophe his last serious writing, and one of the world's most beautiful examples of elegiac prose. Harper's Magazine, December, 1910. And later in the volume, What is Man and Other Essays? Apostrophe apostrophe, XLVIII, letters of 1910. Last trip to Bermuda. Letters to Paine. The last letter, Mark Twain had returned from a month's trip to Bermuda a few days before John died. Now, by his physician's advice, he went back to those balmy islands. He had always loved them, since his first trip there with Twitchell 33 years earlier, and at Hay House, the residence of Vice Consul Allen, where he was always a welcome guest, he could have the attentions and care and comforts of a home. Taking Claude, the butler, as his valet, he sailed January 5th, and presently sent back a letter in which he said, "Again I am leading the ideal life, and am immeasurably content." By his wish, the present writer and his family were keeping the Stormfield house open for him, in order that he might be able to return to its comforts at any time. He sent frequent letters, one or two by each steamer, but as a rule they did not concern matters of general interest. A little after his arrival, however, he wrote concerning an incident of his former visit, a trivial matter but one which had annoyed him. I had been with him in Bermuda on the earlier visit, and as I remember it, there had been some slight oversight on his part in the matter of official etiquette, something which doubtless no one had noticed but himself. To A. B. Paine, in Reading. Bay House, January 11, 1910. Dear Paine, there was a military lecture last night at the officers' mess. Prospect, and as the lecturer honored me with a special and urgent invitation and said he wanted to lecture to me particularly, I being the greatest living master of the platform art, I naturally packed Helen and her mother into the provided carriage and went. As soon as we landed at the door with the crowd, the governor came to me at once, and was very cordial, and apparently as glad to see me as he said he was. So that incident is closed, and pleasantly and entirely satisfactorily. Everything is all right now, and I am no longer in a clumsy and awkward situation. I ate up with that charming Colonel Chapman, and other officers of the regiment, and had a good time. Commandant Peters of the Arnagie will dine here tonight, and arrange a private visit for us to his ship, the crowd to be denied access. Sincerely yours, S50. See, Elan of this letter was Mr. and Mrs. Allen's young daughter, a favorite companion of his walks and drives. Loomis and Ark, mentioned in the letters which follow, were Edward E. Loomis, his nephew by marriage, named by Mark Twain as one of the trustees of his estate, and Charles T. Lark, Mark Twain's attorney. To A. B. Payne, in Reading. Hamilton, Jan. 21, 10. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.